So we have some sort of network which is inhomogeneous, rather than just doing a normal optimization technique on a regular network. We find out that this inhomogeneous network has holographic properties, which are quite a novel and neat thing, which quite a lot of people here have been studying, which is rather nice. So, So I've been studying in the University of Warwick, which most people don't actually know where that is. So Warwick is right in the middle of the UK. It's actually the furthest place from the sea in the entirety of the UK. And within the UK, it's actually really well known as a university. And so, but hopefully it'll become more and more recognized externally. We've actually just won the Fields Medal in the maths department, which might be a nice sort of boost for the university. Ah, great. Okay, so, well, I have a few things to talk about, but if anyone has any questions, please just shout out and I'll try my best to answer them. So we're going to start off looking at strong disorder. So what is disorder and why are we interested in these? So clean systems are all well and good, really beautiful. We can look at these analytically. We can use the beta ansatz or other interesting methods, but they're not actually that real. So we're looking at really disordered systems and actual disorder in that can completely change the physics that's going on. So it's not just smearing out of phase transitions or phase boundaries or moving them. It should get novel and new phases coming out. So this particular phase diagram here, this is the this is a disordered Bose-Hubbard model with one boson per site. And this is calculated using iTensor DMRG. So what you're actually looking at here is the information that comes out of looking at the entanglement entropy properties of a Bose-Hubbard model. So we can actually look, we can build the entire phase diagram just by looking at one parameter, essentially, which is kind of nice. So anyway, we can look at more of these sort of things, but they're actually quite difficult to do numerically. So it's not just the fact that we have to disorder average, which is a real pain. So often you have to just average over thousands of different disorder realizations. But also that we lose symmetries. So there's no translational invariance. And often you're looking at open boundary conditions and things like that. Okay. So what we're looking at in our system is the one-dimensional Heisenberg model with a spin half. And we have a coupling which changes depending on each pair. And we choose this out of a random box distribution. So it's also open, and we actually choose this just because it's really well understood. So it's not just that understand it with clean systems. So beta ansatz is perfect for looking at the clean Heisenberg model. But also when you have the disordered systems, you know a lot from strong disorder renormalization group. So SDRG, so over lunch I was talking to a few people and SDRG seemed to be something that wasn't that well known. So it's the strong disorder renormalization group. And strong in the sense of that the disorder actually determines the final outcome of the system rather than the quantum the nature of it. Also, in some weird sense, some people describe the strong disorder renormalization group as being strong disorder when SDRG works, which is a really weird chicken and egg situation. So what we do is we look for the coupling which is largest, so the JI which is maximum. So when that's for this pair here, because the disorder is really strong, they essentially freeze out of the system. So it seems to be orders of magnitude larger than ones either side. So this is just going to freeze into a singlet, so not really interact with the rest of the system. So we can just kind of remove that completely, then use perturbation theory to get this effective coupling. And then once we have that, we can then start again, find the next highest, and then move and start again. And you continue this until you, in infinite systems, reach a fixed point, and then we can just find out all the information about the system, or you just run out of spins. So this forms what's called the random singlet phase, and actually has a power law correlation function. And it's power law correlation function is kind of what you'd expect for this, because as you go through the system or through the algorithm, you kind of you lose a sense of scale. So each step in the algorithm looks a bit like the rest. So you get these very long range correlations coming in. And if you lose a sense of scale, you pretty much always have a power law, unlike an exponential decay where you have an intrinsic correlation length, for example. Also, you can get entanglement entropy information from this just by essentially cutting into intersections, so A and B, and seeing how many of these singlets you need to cut to separate. And then you find out, on average, how many you need to cut, and then that gives you your entanglement entropy, which turns out to be logarithmic, which is an issue when you're looking at DMRG. Yes?
So the entanglement entropy is measured by averaging over entropy's order?
Yes. But it's you average over all the realizations. So you,
yes. So my question is, how typical is this averaging value?
I actually don't know offhand. It might well be in this paper at the bottom. That's where they do the explicit calculations. Okay, so there's been lots of applications of SDRG over the years. I mean, the original one was in the 1970s, so it's been well used. There's still actually a lot of recent work going on. So it's not just for Heisenberg model. You can do a random transverse fieldizing model. Instead of just having pairs, the couplings, you also look at the size of the actual spin itself with an on-site magnetic field. Also look at bosonic models, quantum rotor model. And actually, there's some really interesting work going on in the spin one Heisenberg model. Because in this paper, Quinto, Hoyos, and Miranda show that there's actually emergent SU3 behavior in there. And there's also interesting properties for people, probably people in this room, about things like Haldane phase and topological order actually come out to these random systems. That's really quite interesting. Also, two-dimensional systems can actually be studied using this method. But the problem with two-dimensional systems is that every time you remove a pair of sites, the geometry of your network completely changes. It's not, so in 1D, you remove two, and you're still with a nice 1D chain, and you have no real problems. But then you end up with this mess in 2D. So there's been work on it, but not as nice as the 1D systems. So what we're actually going to be looking at in our system, this is the basis for our work, is actually the numerical strong disorder minimization group. Yeah, sure.
So in the case where two-dimensional way kind of works, so do you get the same random single
equation? I believe you do. So you get the same sort of the fixed points and things coming out. Okay, so our work is actually based on the numerical strong disorder renormalization group. So this takes its inspiration more from things like the NRG of Wilson and DMRG of White, and looks more than just at spins, just being like one spin, rather than looks at matrices and Hamiltonian matrices and looks at more of the spectrum. In a sense, the Bardas Gupta method basically just takes the one ground state and looks at this effective gap at the bottom. Whereas this, we're actually going to renormalize to select a whole, a larger number of these. We're going to call it chi later on. But we're going to keep a chi of these such that whole SU2 blocks are kept. So then we can actually look at, have a new effective coupling strength, which is going to be related to this gap here. So the importance of that is that when we actually look at the chain, we try and find the pair of sites where you can take away the high energy information, which is furthest away from the low level excitations. So we're going to look at the pair of sites where this part we throw away is furthest away. So when you do that, you essentially build blocks. So instead of just removing pairs of spins, you join blocks together. So this would be one of these effective Hamiltonians, and then you diagonalize it, you keep a certain number of eigenstates, and then use that those eigenvectors to map these couplings either side and build a new block. And this is actually going to be the basis for our algorithm using tensor networks. It actually becomes neater and nicer when you put this in sort of tensor network language. Okay, so tensor networks, I'm aware that many people in this room are really well versed with tensor networks. But, yeah. Yeah, sure.
I wonder when the SDRG fails, right? How should it make sense? I mean, what happens to those blocks that they're simple feature to see?
What happens in what sense?
I mean, you mentioned that, you know, not always it works like this.
Mm-hmm.
So can you give like a simple explanation in this picture of the block, of the forming the blocks, of why?
The classical explanation of well, the classical sign of things failing is when you, when the coupling strengths don't, well, when the this probability distribution doesn't broaden.
Mm-hmm.
So when it, the probability distribution broadens throughout the algorithm, you end up making your SGRG approximation becomes more and more accurate. So this coupling, this pair of in the middle, is becomes more singlet-like. So the ones either side become weaker and weaker in comparison. So, and if it, if they get closer and closer together, it's a sign that the algorithm is failing. So that's kind of the.
Then, like, can you say that if the disorder is strong enough, then SDRG gets better and better?
Usually, you look at the distribution of these of the couplings.
Right.
So that's kind of the way you could look at see where, when it fails and not. Okay, so tensor networks. I'm going to start by just briefly introducing, seeing as most, because lots of you are going to know this already, but introduce some of the notations for it, and so actually a second notation which I use quite a lot, but I've only ever seen it in one other paper. Okay, so why tensor networks? So we want to model our quantum many-body systems. We want to find out the properties, experimental properties of matter, and maybe even be able to design new matters. But the problem with modeling these is that the Hilbert space grows exponentially in size. So if you're going to try and model this on a computer, your Hamiltonian matrix just will grow exponentially and you'll quickly run out of memory, particularly when you have disorder systems and you have few symmetries. So what we want to do is have a simulation, an efficient simulation, so polynomial in memory and time, and we also have it as general as possible. So looking at different Hamiltonians, bosons, fermions, ideally in higher dimensions, but that's kind of difficult at the moment still. And we also want to avoid the sign problem, which quantum Monte Carlo has with fermions and frustrated systems. That's a really nice introduction in this paper here. We also want to easily extract information from these wave functions. So things like correlation functions in tensor networks are quite simple to calculate. Just contract a network, and out pops your number. So we're actually going to use diagrammatic notation. So when you have all of these different tensors all contracted together, you quickly lose sight of what's going on when you look at just the mathematics. So what we're going to do is introduce this diagrammatic notation, where you can quickly and easily see what's connected to what and what's contracted, and easily build algorithms. So this is actually the contraction of an MPS with an operator, which is, I'm calling the Hamiltonian here, with another MPS. So in these diagrams, we have a shape, which here's a circle, any shape could be our tensor. We have a leg or index, so this is a vector, so it's got only one index. Matrices have two, and tensors, so on and so forth, have higher numbers of indices. And then contraction of indices is just summing over the repeated index. So like doing an inner product of a vector, or vector matrix multiplication, or any contraction of any higher number. So matrix product states are the simplest tensor networks and the most used tensor networks. So these have one tensor per site. So each one of these is a spin index. And it's actually really useful to be able to put an upper limit on the number of elements that these indices have. And then you can perform a variational update onto this and try and find the contents of these tensors, which minimize the energy. So these sort of things are well understood. And these are the basis of the DMRG algorithms. So review here, but actually using the iTensor libraries at the moment, which have this all built in, which is very, very easy to use. Similarly to be able to represent any a wave function by a MPS. You can represent operators by MPOs. So in, you can, the matrix operators, you can usually write a matrix operator in terms of an MPO. Just, it's, you're limited by where, how big these bond dimensions are. But these are really neat ways of describing Hamiltonians. So just like say, nearest neighbor Hamiltonians can be very, very simply written in terms of these. And this is gonna be how we actually start our algorithm. So as I said, putting in nearest neighbor Hamiltonians is nice and simple. So this is gonna be the form of our matrix product operator, actually when you encode the information into it. So in this sense, this is a matrix of matrices. So each one of these is gonna be our on-site operator, say a spin operator. And this is gonna be the matrix if you're looking at this sort of horizontal virtual dimension. Once you're gonna look at this in terms of these diagrams, which are known as matrix product diagrams. And the only place I've ever seen these before is this paper by Crosswhite and Bacon, but I really like them. They're actually, to me, the neatest way of visualizing the Hamiltonians. So constructing Hamiltonians just to put into MPS codes and things, you can just put together like this. Where in here, each one of these, so this is gonna be one index of our tensor or matrix. It's gonna be the other index. And an arrow connecting the two is just gonna be the element of that matrix. So 1, 1 is gonna be I, 1, 2 is AI, and so on and so forth. And then the boundaries, we're gonna have just vectors rather than a full matrix. Then contracting these all across the virtual dimension, this is basically just putting all of these diagrams side by side and then tracing out all the different individual paths through the system. So if you'd start off on the left-hand side to the right-hand side, you've got 1, 2, so on, and then 2, 3, 3, 4, just as we want. So using these, you can have a nice idea of what's going on. And it'll be very, very useful later on to introduce the on-site components. So things like magnetic fields and chemical potentials, like we'll have this on-site element, which connects the, essentially the top to the bottom of this diagram within the matrix itself. And our Hamiltonian, which is the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, will have a similar form, but we're going to split our spins off into plus, minus, and z, as is normal. So we end up with our bond dimension being 5. But for simplicity later on, we're going to group these 2, 3, and 4 together, just so we don't get lost in a mess of indices and arrows. So just performing this sort of contraction, putting these all together, we'll get the Hamiltonian we want. So this is really going to be the starting point for our algorithm. And when you should perform these explicitly using matrices, you're going to contract two together, say 2 and 3. You end up with the 3 and the 4 still there to connect to the neighboring sites, but the on-site components, so the 2 and the S3, S4, will end up being on the on-site component. And that'll actually be quite important. We'll find out.
So this is a way of conveniently rewriting the original.
Yes, absolutely.
Anticipating.
Yeah. So it actually encodes, because we have things like the identities here, it actually encodes the fact we have a tensor network or a tensor product state. So we end up having a Hilbert space in principle with I's all the way along here, which are tensor producted together. Okay. So our work. So what we're looking at doing is reformulating this SDRG, the strong disorder renormalization group, in terms of tensors. So what we're looking at is looking for the pair of sites with the largest gap, or which is I mentioned earlier, with the largest gap between the essentially the lowest states that you throw that you the low states you throw away and the higher states you keep. So you contract those into a bigger tensor, and you fuse into a matrix. And as I said, when you do that, the on-site component of that becomes the essentially the II plus one spins. So from that, you can diagonalize, and you keep a certain number of spins, and then use that as your eigenvectors from that as your method of renormalizing. Yes? No, this is just making this tensor into matrices, basically. So when you have this is explicitly in terms of these two different sites. When you fuse these together, you make those two different sites into one index. No truncation there. Yes.
What's the gap of an NPO tensor between a
contact NPO tensor? Okay, sure. So when you start out, it's just going to have our Hamiltonian, and at the start, the gap between the there's only going to be one gap. It's going to be the gap between the lowest state and the three excited states. So that's going to be for the Heisenberg Hamiltonian for two sites.
For two sites.
Yeah, it's a two site term.
So you isolate that low
site
from the rest of the Hamiltonian.
So when you start out, you know that gap is going to be one times by j. So that's you have to start off with your gaps. It's going to be your set of j's.
That's fine. I'm just wondering. I mean, this is not the only Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian term s times j's.
Mm-hmm.
J s times j's. You have on that pair of sides.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the only term that is acting on the sides, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sides are also interacting with other sides.
Yeah.
So are you ignoring that?
At the moment, yes. So this is Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like performing this singlet construction. So to start off with, we diagonalize that. So we have a matrix which we diagonalize. We keep a certain number of energy states depending on the chi that we select to start off with. Then we can use those eigenvectors to then renormalize this pair of sites.
Okay, yeah. When you say you diagonalize that, you mean that box that we have
there? So we only the on-site components.
So the I'm bothered by the indices, the mm-hmm. example indices that connect both that tensor with neighboring tensors. Mm-hmm. We're not going to ignore that.
At this point, yes, but we'll soon reintroduce those. Okay. So just as we had here, this is what we're going to have to start off with. On the first step, we have this matrix here. This is the thing we diagonalize. And then we use those to essentially renormalize this, including the legs either side. And you can reshape this set of eigenvectors into an isometric tensor. So an isometric tensor has the property that if you connect it in this manner, you get just the identity. So this is explicitly what we do to perform the full renormalization. You contract these isometries with these two sites, and that all in one renormalizes the couplings either side as well as the block on site. Then you diagonalize either side to update this distribution of gaps. And from then on, you can select the highest gap again and continue until you run out of sites. We're doing an open boundary condition, so you do just run out of sites. Yeah.
Just because I don't have experience with this technique, say you want to do like VMRG for this chain, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was under the impression that VMRG is kind of unbiased in the sense that you do the sweeping through the chain,
mm-hmm.
minimizing the tensors. It seems that what you're doing here is kind of biased, right? In the sense that you are sort of identifying some part of the chain that has the strongest coupling,
yeah.
kind of forgetting about that, and maybe you're going to. So, how do you, maybe my question is, how do you connect what you're doing with kind of an unbiased DMRG minimization?
So,
or maybe that unbiased DMRG minimization is strong disorder, it is very hard to do, and
yeah.
I just don't know.
Yeah, it is. Okay. So, that's kind of the point is we're trying to bias it to where these are locally strongly coupled. So when doing DMRG of disorder systems, you get quite easily stuck into local minima, and you also have proper problems like with these, you have very long range interactions, which aren't very well described by DMRG. You have to increase chi in DMRG quite high to include everything. Okay, so this is back to my MP diagrams. So that renormalization effectively removes one site and then takes all of these things, nice color on this next site, the page. All of these are the on-site components. So we have a block and the two coupling Hamiltonians. Those are represented by the one new tensor, and those also renormalize these coupling tensors either side. So explicitly using some mathematics, these are the equations we get. And the nice thing about this formulation is that just performing that contraction does the entirety of the Hikihara RG method, just in that contraction. So rather than just looking at mapping two MPOs to one site each time, it's nice, we end up contracting our system. We can also look at the set of isometries and the set of vectors as a wave function acting on the original MPO. When you do that, you end up with a tree tensor network. So it's a nice way of, it actually maps out where all the different contractions happened within the system. Also, we end up with having an extra dimension perpendicular to the chain, which we call the holographic dimension because it's in reference to things like the mirror and ADS-CFT. So in addition to that, in ADS-CFT and in mirror, as shown by these three nice papers, there's various properties are related to the geometry of the system. So Ryo and Taganaki showed that in ADS-CFT, the entanglement entropy of a region B on the surface of our ADS-CFT is related to the minimal surface which connects these two regions, not just the region, the boundary on that surface. And similarly, with correlation functions, we expect them to be related to the minimal path length which connects two points on the surface. So it's not necessarily related to just the actual distance between them on the lattice. So in tensor networks, that almost seems to be a coarse-grained version of the ADS-CFT. So we have the same sort of ideas coming up again. So if this is going to be our region, which I've highlighted in blue, then we can look at the entanglement entropy we expect to be related to the number of legs you have to cut to separate that region from the rest. And similarly, if you have a correlation function, expect it to be related to the path length between these two sites. So in this case, the path length is defined by the number of tensors you have to cross. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so back to our tree sensing network. So we can perform things like contractions of correlation functions quite efficiently just because of the properties of these networks. So we have isometries here. So the isometric property is that two of these contracted together just gives I, which is some chalk, which I'm sure. So it's just that diagram. So all of these will just disappear. So we're just left with an identity for those. So this is essentially contracting the things which are in the causal cone for the operator. Also, we've drawn on this path going between the two, which we'll come across later. So contraction of that network over for each possible two-point correlation function on the lattice. Across, we did 2,000 disorder realizations. And then we're looking at how the correlation functions change with just the separation on average. We end up with this kind of interesting shape. So it's a log-log plot. So we have this kind of straight-ish, which is our power law. We also have this nice or interesting kick-up at the end, which is related to the boundaries of the system. So it actually shows that towards the edges of the system, you end up having it more correlated at the edges than you have for some of the shorter path lengths or shorter correlations. You also notice that there's a difference between odd and even numbers in here, and that's related to the fact that we have a singlet phase. So singlets always act on neighbors. So if we have chalk again, so if we have some sort of singlet, and then longer range singlets, for example, these singlets will only act on ones which are an odd number away. So if we move that, those two, that's going to be three away. Say that's going to be one, it's going to be three. The larger one's going to be five. It's always going to be odd. So because of this singlet phase, we end up having the odd and even different by a factor that turns out to be about 1.25, which is calculated in this paper here. So that's something we can correct for when we're looking at this. Okay, so we're actually going to now look at how the correlation function is related to the geometry of these systems. So this is what we're expecting. So we have our spin-spin correlation function should be related to e to the minus alpha d as before, but when averaged over all the different disorder realizations. So just by looking at these systems, we know that this can be similar to this. So it's going to be e to the minus alpha of expectation value of d, which, as this shows, is logarithmic, which is where we get our approximate power law from. So back to this, we're going to do a fitting of that to our data. So this is the same data. We've corrected for this odd-even effect. So it's a nice, a lot smoother now. And the red line is the fit of the average of e to the alpha d. This should be a minus sign there. So it's actually an incredibly good fit. You know, having all of these, the upturn, again, even some of that actually bumps in this. Yes?
Where did the numbers, the minus 2 and the minus 1, what's
that? Okay, so the minus 2 is just because that's what we expect in the thermodynamic limit. So I just put that on just as a reference. So that's the blue line. The 1.78, so this line here isn't actually straight. So it starts off sort of flatter than normal, and becomes straighter in the sort of in the bulk. So it's just a fit to the straight part in the bulk of this. Actually, when you increase system size, it becomes more and more like 2. So this, for smaller systems, end up being sort of flatter, and then in the thermodynamic limit, you end up sort of tending towards 2. And it's kind of nice that you get this upturn here, which is kind of described almost perfectly by the tensor network. So entanglement entropy, so in a similar way to correlation functions, entanglement entropy is, the calculations can be done, made simpler by looking at the tensor network. So all of these can be removed because they're isometries. Actually, these can be removed as well because although the elements of the density matrix will change, the actual entanglement entropy described won't. So all we need to do is contract the tensors which connect the two blocks, and then diagonalize that, because it's going to be a density matrix. And from that density matrix, we can get our entanglement entropy. And again, we've drawn on this as being our minimal surface. So in this case, we're cutting 1, 2, 3 legs. And this is something we'll look at and look at analyzing the geometry of the system. Okay, so this is what I call bipartitions. So it's taking our chain and chopping into two using one cut. So because it's open, you can do that. And we then look at when taking all possible cuts throughout the chain, how these the entanglement entropies change. So this at the bottom is the average. So when we take all cuts over averaged over all systems, looking at how they change with the system size. So it's a logarithmic increase, which I guess is to be expected from the SDRG. Also, if you look at the maximum entanglement entropy of all your cuts when averaged over all the different realizations, you also get a lot stronger logarithmic power. So, yes?
Did you actually use DMRG for this part?
So this is SDRG for this part. So I've done DMRG on it as well. And this particular thing here is why DMRG is quite hard. So you have these really long range correlations, which unless you have a really high chi, you miss one. So then the entanglement entropy just drops by it's actually by the number one, which is quite interesting. Okay, so then we can look at the blocks. So when we take a block in the center of the chain, so this is so we can then compare with the thermodynamic limit. So this is the result of Raphael and Moore, and we have, which is the log 2/3, which is the dotted line. And so for the, until halfway up the chain, we have quite a nice logarithmic scaling. Okay. Actually, also that it fits the idea of having an effective central charge of 1 times by log 2, which is it's a SCRG result. So we then look back at doing at the geometry of the system and see how this notion of cutting the different legs affects the entanglement entropy. So what we have in this diagram, we have both the bipartitions and the blocks. The black is the entanglement entropy, and the red is the entanglement entropy per leg. So we look at the amount of entanglement entropy which each cut provides. And ends up saturating away from the small and the large systems, the areas, it ends up saturating to a constant for both, which is the same constant for both of these, which ends up being just 0.47. Okay, so I actually blasted through this much faster than I was expecting. I was expecting more questions, to be honest. So what we've actually done to conclude is produce a tensor network method which is determined by the disorder in the system. So it's not like the DMRG, as mentioned before, but it's dependent on where these strong couplings are. And it builds this kind of holographic tensor network, which is then contains some of the information, these ideas that have been floating around for quite a while, that we have correlation functions which scale with this path length, and entanglement entropy which scales with this minimal surface. So we're actually going to be looking at what happens when you look at spin 1 and spin 3/2 chains, because as I mentioned before, these actually have a lot richer physics, and see if these sort of ideas can then lend sort of new ideas to these areas. And before I go, to mention a few other things I've been working on whilst I have a few moments. So we've been looking at doing iTensor DMRG for disordered systems. So this is a really nice tool. So you can do a lot of nice numerics with DMRG. And so particularly we're looking at the Bose-Hubbard model. We also done some work on purely looking at the geometry. So if you have an A tree graph, it's not actually that obvious what you expect this average path length to be as a sort of a pseudo correlation function. So if you say set the separation to be say 5 sites, if you have let's say a normal tree tensor net, what is the expected path length? Also, we've been looking at for the set of all binary trees or binary trees called the Catalan trees. When you average over all of these, what sort of things you expect? So it's actually quite a neat little problem. So we'll also be looking at spin 1 and maybe even excited states for DMRG methods, which can be quite useful for people studying localization in many body systems. Great. So thank you very much for your attention. Please, questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that for whatever hands on, I can always perform this kind of. Mm-hmm. Well, the strong disorder.
So the strong disorder makes this accurate. So if we go back to the start. So in the original methods, the fact that we have strong disorder means that we can perform this type of action. And just as in our method, we are performing essentially a more accurate version of this. We can contain some more information, but not necessarily all of the information. So, so what was the question, sorry?
So, I mean, what is the difference between using sentinel bombs from a strong disorder system
A weak disorder, say. So for when you have weaker and weaker disorder, this becomes less and less accurate, because you have more of the clean system physics coming through as well. So it becomes not right to say that this is true. So we actually have to look at perhaps some more complicated networks, maybe even like a disorder mirror or something like that to include some of the other information. So, possibly, but if you look at the clean Heisenberg antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model, you expect a polynomial decay correlations as well. It's a different power, so it's not necessarily just that the fact you have a power law correlation functions means that you have this. I hope that answers your question.
The accuracy of your calculation depends on the disorder getting stronger as you perform renormalization. What numerical measure do you have of the relative strength of disorder at the beginning to end compared with the end?
So essentially, you can look at the spread of the couplings. So you have a set of these. You can look at how they're spread. So if they become more and more essentially bunched, then you end up having sort of less and less accurate.
How do you expect different phases to manifest themselves within this kind of approach?
That's something that I would quite like to study more, actually. So this is more explicitly just the singlet phase. And I expect that when you move towards things which aren't just the singlet phase, you end up with different geometries. So this method that we've been using should work for what's called the random large spin phase as well. So that's where you take, instead of ups and downs being grouped together to get singlets, you also have things, say, two downs in a load of things like that can be then grouped together to become like one big down, for example. So those are the things you can actually then describe using this. And we haven't actually gone through all the analysis of that yet, but I think it'd be quite interesting to see how that changes the kind of the structure of the trees. Yes?
Could you please go to the slide showing the scaling of internal entropy and the function of the system size?
Yes, it's right at the bottom. Which one? That one?
Yeah, this one.
Yeah.
So could you explain again, what are those two three lines?
These two lines?
Yeah.
Okay, so the one at the bottom is this almost like a double average. So we average over all of the cuts you can do to split your system into two. Uh-huh. So in this case, it's going to be L minus one possible cuts. Then also average over all possible disorder realizations we do. So that just gives like an average of the amount of entanglement in there. And this one looks at the average sort of max or peak entanglement. Oh. So if you actually were to perform these sort of...
peak over the different cuts?
Yes. So if I can get...
What's the... have L plus one cuts with L minus one cuts to look at the maximum.
Yes, that's right. So if you actually to perform that, those calculations, you end up getting, say, a graph of Let's call it x, the position at which you cut. And this is going to be some entanglement here. It's actually, it's not very constant. In each disorder realization, there's obviously lots of disorder. So you end up with something which looks kind of like that, just a hugely noisy thing. And there's also, there's odd even effects still. So you end up with things which are very much larger than others. So what we're looking at is, this is taking this largest one for each of the disorder realizations and then make an average over disorder realizations.
So which one follows the scanning from the randoms of, you know, the result of Raphael and Moore?
So the one that follows Raphael Moore is not the bipartitions, but this, the block in the middle. Because right. There's a...
But presumably, you can have a single count, then the result would be just a half.
Yes, but this is a different... this is the scaling of a different thing. So this is the system size increasing as an open boundary system size, rather than the block size in the middle of the chain.
So given the big deviation between those two curves, it seems to me that there is a long tail of the counting statistics of the entanglement entropy function.
Sure. Right? Yeah, but I could well be right.
Can you also show the next slide, because I missed that?
Yep, so sure.
Or maybe it's the one after, but you checked this hypothesis that it's like related to the number of cuts of the network that separate this basically the number of cuts in this minimum service. Like you had checked that in the last slide. Is that right?
Yeah.
So could you explain again, like, what was the difference in the upper box and the lower box?
Okay, so the upper box, this is when we're cutting, so this axis along the x-axis is this x, so it's the position at which you cut. So this is like this, but averaged over however many disorder realizations we did. So this is where the black is the entanglement entropy calculated, and the red is the entanglement entropy per leg cut. So this is for bipartitions, like this. And this one is for the size of the block in the middle of the chain. So with the L, which we call LB. So going from 0 in the middle, or 1 in the middle, to this is the full system size. Which is why you have this, it peaks and then tails off towards the end again. Yes?
Is there an equivalent of the discarded weight in this procedure?
This
test the quality?
Good question. Not that we did, but it'd be quite an interesting thing to think about having something like that. I agree.
Well, let's thank Andrew again.
Thank you.